Hello, and welcome to the CISC podcast. In each edition of this series, you'll have the chance to meet a CISC staff member or other educational professional involved with the CISC community. We think you will find these podcasts of great value as a variety of people share their unique insights in their respective fields. Now, please enjoy this edition of the podcast as our host, Bob Kretzmer, speaks with our guest.
A July 28th article in the Bakersfield Californian informed our community that the spread of the coronavirus jumped significantly during the previous week. Students, teachers all over Kern County are preparing to return to the classroom for the new school year. It's important that we as a community continue to stay informed on recent developments related to the pandemic. To help us understand new developments, I had the opportunity to sit down with Kim Hernandez, an epidemiologist with the Kern County Public Health Department. Kim has been with the department for over 10 years. She has a Bachelor of Science degree in psychobiology from the University of California, Los Angeles. In addition, Kim has a master's in public health with a concentration in biostatistics. I think you will enjoy this conversation we had with Kim to help us stay informed on all the recent developments concerning the pandemic. Kim, thank you for being with us today. It's a pleasure to meet with someone from Kern County Public Health as we continue to navigate our way through this pandemic, and any education and further knowledge we can share with our school community is always appreciated. So we really hope we can tap into your expertise.
Thank you for having me.
What can we tell our local school districts regarding the recent guidance on mask wearing issued by the California Department of Public Health? And I'll add to that, Kim, it's my understanding that today, July 28th, 2021, just a few hours before we're meeting, there was some additional guidance given by the CDPH. Can you comment on that?
Certainly. So on June 15th, the California Department of Public Health, they issued a update to their guidance on face coverings. And that was again updated on June 24th. The guidance says that persons should wear masks indoors in K-12 school settings, as well as childcare settings and other youth settings. And that's regardless of vaccination status. So the California Department of Public Health currently states that all persons in school settings need to be masked. Yesterday, the Centers for Disease Control recommended that all persons mask indoors, regardless of vaccination status, in areas with higher substantial community transmission. Kern County is currently in substantial community transmission, therefore that applies in our community. Just today, the California Department of Public Health further updated their masking guidance to align with CDC's guidance from yesterday. And in that, it does say that in California, they are recommending universal masking indoors statewide. And so this doesn't affect the K-12 guidance, because in the K-12 guidance, it already said that the requirement is for all persons in a K-12 school setting to be masked. So there's no change between what was originally published by CDPH in June and what has updated today. The updates pertain to other areas of the community, but in K-12 schools, masking is recommended universally for all students, staff, and any visitors.
There have been many rumors that have circulated regarding the effects of mask wearing, the impact of mask wearing. And I was wanting to ask you, are there any short or long-term health effects that we should be concerned about related to children of any age wearing masks?
So there's been a number of studies that have been conducted regarding mask wearing. They have included healthcare workers, adults, older adults, as well as people with lung conditions. So far, those studies have not found any difference in the oxygen levels or the carbon dioxide levels while wearing a mask. The American Academy of Pediatrics earlier this month issued a COVID-19 guidance for safe schools. And in that document, AAP recommends universal masking in schools. They gave several reasons, and one of them being that a significant proportion of our students are not currently eligible for vaccination, so they remain susceptible to COVID-19. And that they also indicated that there are continued concerns about variants that are circulating that may be more easily spread among children and adolescents as well as adults. There is a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, which was published earlier this year in March, and it looked at masking in infants and children. And that found that when they compared the results of children who were unmasked during normal play, as well as when those same children were masked, they again didn't find any significant difference in respiratory function. And so a lot of the concern people have expressed about wearing masks, particularly in children, is the fear of a buildup of carbon dioxide in the mask. And we need to remember that carbon dioxide is a tiny, tiny molecule, right? This is very, very small. It's about 232 picometers across. And so a picometer is 0.00000001 of a millimeter. It is tiny. And that is so small that there shouldn't be any difficulty in that carbon dioxide leaving a mask. You know, we are very careful that when we talk about masking, that we are looking for breathable materials for that specific reason. So the carbon dioxide can exit and, you know, enough oxygen can enter that you can have appropriate respiratory function. Remember that wearing a mask is intended to keep respiratory droplets from spreading, from either leaving the source who might be infectious or from you, breathing it in from somebody else who may have a COVID-19 infection. And we're looking at those respiratory droplets and we're trying to avoid transmission of the COVID-19 virus, that is much, much bigger than a carbon dioxide molecule. And so the purpose is to trap these larger viral particles and keep them from moving back and forth. And the intent is not to keep air or oxygen or carbon dioxide from flowing between the masks. And so at this time, there's no indication that wearing a mask, even long-term, has any significant impact on a respiratory function. Remember that healthcare workers have been wearing these types of masks for years and years and years. We know many people who undergo hours and hours long surgeries, and those healthcare providers continue to be masked during the entire time. So we have no reason to believe at this time that there's any adverse effect of masking on the respiratory function of children.
Going forward, what advice or what do you think is the best way we can protect our local student population from the ill effects of the coronavirus?
We know that vaccination is the fastest, safest, most controlled setting in which to develop immunity against COVID-19. We also know that at this time, the vast majority of our children are not currently eligible to be vaccinated. So masking is an additional layer of protection to help reduce transmission. Physical distancing is an additional layer of protection to help reduce transmission. Improving ventilation in indoor settings is an additional layer of protection. There's lots of other things that we don't talk about as much as more, but still remain really important. You know, simple things like washing your hands, covering your cough, staying home when you're sick, you know, staying home if you may have been exposed to somebody and could become sick. Those are all layers of protection that we apply in order to keep our children as safe as possible. These are all sort of cumulative effects. They all work synergistically to reduce risk overall so that as we work towards getting all of our children back in school in person, that all of these things together help create the safest environment we can possible for all of our kids.
It's my understanding that children as young as 12 and up can currently get the vaccination. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Do you have any thoughts or any inside knowledge as to possibly when children below the age of 12 may be eligible for vaccinations?
So the clinical trials are ongoing right now. They've been going on for several months. I couldn't say for sure, but people are talking about potentially this coming winter that it may, you know, we will conclude those trials after the FDA reviews all of the evidence, that if they determine that it is appropriate to authorize the vaccine for younger populations, that will happen hopefully come winter, early 2022.
Another concern that's been expressed mostly through media outlets is the fact that the current vaccinations are being used under an emergency use authorization. Some have indicated they would prefer to wait until full authorization is granted by the Food and Drug Administration before they would step up and become vaccinated. Can you address that concern? It's my understanding that under the emergency use authorization, millions of vaccinations have been provided, and reported deaths or serious reactions as a result of being vaccinated. In general, my understanding is that it has been nominal or minimal. So what do we say to someone who has elected to not be vaccinated based on those facts?
So the first thing we want to help people understand is, what is an emergency use authorization? You know, there is a full FDA approval, which we are used to hearing. You know, all kinds of products and biologics have been approved by the FDA for its intended use. An emergency use authorization is a designation given by FDA where they have weighed the risk and the benefits of using that product. And so you can have emergency use authorizations for new products like the newly developed COVID-19 vaccinations. You can also have emergency use authorization for existing products for new uses. And so the EUAs existed long before COVID-19. They've been used for many other infectious disease conditions where something urgently needed attention. There are emergency use authorizations for treatments for COVID-19 because the benefit of that treatment outweighs the potential harm or the, there's reason to believe that the benefit would outweigh that harm based on the need to treat somebody right now, because not treating would result in, you know, severe illness or death. And so in understanding why we have an emergency use authorization while these products are still going through the process of review for full FDA approval is really important. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has submitted to FDA for full approval of that vaccine. That FDA is still reviewing it at this time. And so this is sort of in the interim, so that because the need is so great right now to reduce the risk of COVID-19, and that there is reasonable evidence to believe that the things that are being authorized do have benefit, that FDA allows us to use that because there's an immediate need for this intervention. And so in helping people understand that, you know, that FDA is continuing to assess whether or not these products, which include treatments as well as vaccine, meet criteria for full FDA approval, that we didn't want to wait until that full FDA approval was granted, because in the interim, you know, we've had hundreds of thousands of people become sick who needed treatment, and that vaccinations has prevented hundreds of thousands of more people from becoming sick. And so we recognize that it is not what a lot of people are used to, but that same risk-benefit analysis occurs. And while we're doing further studies, more in-depth information, that we want to not wait too long, because part of the concern of saying, of people saying, I'll wait till it gets FDA approved, is COVID's not going to wait. It's not going to wait for you. COVID is increasing in our community and increasing throughout the state and throughout the nation. Your risk of infection is increasing right now. And if you could be protected, even if it is a small amount of protection, small amounts of protection are better than none. And so it's one of these things where you have to weigh that risk and that benefit. There are a lot of unknowns with COVID as an infection. You know, we're still only in the first year of people having COVID and what happens with the long-term sequelae that people are experiencing. Some people have complications. Some people are not fully recovering from COVID-19, continue to have lower lung function, you know, and struggling a lot with the after effects of COVID. And so we have to weigh what those potential risks are of the COVID-19 infection, looking into the future, as well as the potential risks of something like a new treatment or a new designation for a treatment or a new vaccine. And so, you know, we're encouraging people to think this through and to learn as much as you can and to make that decision. But we don't want to get to the end of this, or we don't want to have an individual person who gets sick who says, I wish I would have done this sooner because I might have been able to prevent being in the hospital. I might have been able to prevent, you know, a friend or family member from dying if we had engaged in the preventative measures that we have available.
Do we have any parallels in our history as a country related to vaccines and disease that we can equate with our current situation? I say that because in my reading of history, I understand that with respect to polio, it did take several months, maybe even years for the majority of the population or the significant numbers in the population to ultimately take the vaccine or recommend the vaccine. Does this current situation parallel with that in any way, as far as you know?
I think in any new situation we have, you know, whether it's vaccine-related, technology-related, anything like that, that we have sort of early adopters and late adopters, right? You will always have people who, for whatever reason in their experience, jump right in. You know, if you've had a terrible experience with COVID, if you've known people who have died, if you've known people who've been in the ICU, who've been severely ill, then your perception of your risk of COVID is very different than someone who has not known anybody who's had those unfortunate circumstances. And so it's, you know, there are a lot of individual factors, a lot of individual perceptions of what your actual risk is that compel us to act or encourage us to wait and see. You know, some of us might be wait and see type of people in, you know, buying the new latest gadget, but because of our experience with this infection and how it's affected our, you know, our personal lives, our community lives, our workplaces, our schools, that, you know, as part of trying to move forward, that they may be early adopters in getting vaccinated. On the other hand, other people who might, you know, typically run out and get the latest, greatest new technology might be waiting and seeing with something, you know, like the COVID-19 vaccine. And so it really just depends on a person. You know, historically, we know for something like H1N1, you know, the influenza, the novel influenza virus that circulated 10 years ago, that we had lines around the block for people to get vaccinated. We had long lines and lots of waiting lists for people to get vaccinated for COVID when the vaccine first became available. And so there's parallels that we can draw from history that it's something that we see where there is a rush for people to be vaccinated because we have lots of concerns about COVID. And, you know, at the time vaccine was first available, we still had hundreds and thousands of people being infected every day. And as that has changed, people's risks of COVID have changed. As cases went down, as we moved, you know, in the late spring and summer months, people felt less urgency because they didn't see lots of people around them with COVID. We didn't have the surge in the hospitals that we were hearing about all the time. And so that, you know, may have changed people's willingness to wait in line for a vaccine, to run out and get it. But, you know, historically we know, so this is a place in history for all of us about, you know, what are we doing to contribute to the overall well-being of ourselves and our community? And what measures are we willing to take in that?
Is the, or are the current vaccines available? Are they effective against the Delta variant that we have heard so much about in the news recently?
So there are a lot of studies still going on regarding the Delta variant. We do know that in the theme of these recent studies, that the existing vaccines do provide protection against the Delta variant. There is some evidence that's coming out that the vaccines may not be as effective at preventing infection and illness from the Delta variant as they do with what we call the ancestral strain, the original strain of COVID-19. But the vaccines are showing to be very effective at preventing severe illness and death. So what that means is that as the Delta variant is circulating, while you might still get sick, even though you've been vaccinated, your chances of being hospitalized, of being admitted to the ICU, or dying of COVID-19, the Delta variant that's circulating, are very, very low after you've been fully vaccinated.
We've heard stories in the news recently about individuals who've been admitted to the hospital after a COVID-19 diagnosis, asking their doctor or the nurse in the hospital, can I be vaccinated now? What is the reason for or having that vaccine given to someone who is actually going through the process of the illness after diagnosis?
Right. So vaccines are intended to prevent illness, right? Vaccines are intended to induce an immune response so that you develop antibodies and that if you get an infection, your body will respond very quickly and fight it off. Once you are already ill, the vaccine has limited ability to help, because you've already induced that immune response, right? You've had an infection, your body is now fighting it. And so it's not to say that people who've had COVID-19 shouldn't be vaccinated. They actually should be vaccinated after they've recovered, because they have found that the antibodies that develop after vaccination appear to persist longer in your system. Your body remembers it longer, compared to people who get what we call a natural infection. They get an actual COVID-19 infection. You do have some short-term immunity, but it appears that getting vaccinated prolongs that immune response, so you remember and can fight off a future infection much faster. And so the vaccination at the time that you are sick is not going to help your immune system respond. It's already mounted that response. That's why you're sick, and it's already sort of on its way. They also don't want to conflate the potential side effects of the vaccine with your current symptoms. We know that, you know, common side effects of the COVID-19 vaccine can include things like a fever or chills or headache. And they don't want to have to tease out what is a vaccine side effect from what is an actual symptom of a COVID-19 infection. So it would be unusual to be vaccinated while you're going through your infection. After you've recovered, when you're out of the hospital again, your doctor very, very well may recommend you still get vaccinated, even though you've had a COVID-19 infection and that you've gotten better, because we think that the antibodies induced from the vaccine may actually last longer than from that infection.
And can I ask, what causes a variant to develop?
So variants happen all the time. You know, as viruses circulate, it's much like the telephone game. You know, as it goes from person to person, little pieces of information may change. Much of the time, those changes have no effect on us. It doesn't affect anything about that virus. On occasion, what will happen is that change can make it more likely to more easily transmitted. That change could make it cause more severe illness. And when those things happen, that's when we take notice of that change, because something that becomes more easily transmitted becomes the predominant virus. You know, we saw that with the B.1.1.7, which was sort of the first variant that everybody was talking about. That's Alpha. And now we're at Delta, another variant that has since then changed and sort of adapted to be more transmissible. And what happens is, as those strains come about, if they cause more severe illness, if they don't, if the illness they cause don't respond to the existing treatments, if they escape the immune response that we've already developed against it, that's when those become variants or strains of concern. And you know, if a variant changes enough, our immune system may not recognize it, and then we run the risk of having a reinfection, or if we've never been infected and we're immunized against it, getting that first infection because the immune response doesn't know that that infection is bad and isn't able to fight it off.
As we approach the fall and winter, is it advisable to wear a mask in indoor settings, even if you have received the vaccine? And I'm aware now of the revised recommendations from the California Department of Public Health and the Centers for Disease Control. But can I relax my mask wearing indoors, even if I'm in a public setting, just with a group of people that I know who have been vaccinated? What is the recommendation on that?
So, you know, right now the current recommendation is that even people who are fully vaccinated in areas where the community transmission is high or substantial, that we continue to wear our masks. It's largely because we're still learning a lot about what's happening with the Delta variant. And it's also a measure to help avoid sort of that sort of discretionary piece where of knowing when you should and when you shouldn't, you know, with whom and without whom. You know, in general, you don't have to mask around people who are within your own household. But as soon as you go outside your household, you know, we all have points of contact where as those circles grow, the risk increases because one person could get it and pass it to the next person who passes it to the next person who passes it to you. So currently we are recommending that masks be worn indoors. That may change if we get into the winter seasons and the rate of transmission goes down. You know, if we get to a place where the rate of transmission is low, then we may feel comfortable taking off our masks in indoor settings again. We also need to remember that COVID-19 is not the only thing out there. Masking prevents transmission of flu. You know, we talk about flu season every year. We know that circulates in the winter. We know that there's other viruses and bacteria that circulate, particularly during winter months, that are responsible for things like the common cold or RSV, which can be potentially fatal in young children. And so that masking can help prevent the transmission of all of those types of respiratory infections, not just COVID-19.
And tell me if I'm wrong, Kim, but we did see the benefit of mask wearing last winter, if I understand correctly, with fewer hospital admissions, emergency admissions due to those other viruses that are still with us. Is that right?
That is true. You know, we found last year during the winter seasons where we typically expect to see lots of flu circulating that we had very few cases of diagnosed flu, very few people hospitalized due to flu, as well as other respiratory diseases that that tend to be tracked like RSV. And so a lot of the conversation has been, you know, partially that people were, social distancing and avoiding one another, but also that, you know, in settings where people were together, they often were continuing to mask, which protected against COVID-19, as well as these other respiratory infections that tend to circulate during that time.
Another term that's we've heard a lot about is this idea of herd immunity, and I was wondering if you could take a moment and explain to our listeners what is meant by herd immunity.
Certainly. So herd immunity is the concept that if I can't get infected, I can't pass it to you. And if you and I can't get infected, then we won't pass it to our friends and family. And if our friends and families can't get infected, they won't pass it to their friends and family. So the more of us who are immune, the less transmission there is, and the easier it is to protect our most vulnerable people. You know, we know that people who have weakened immune systems, newborn babies, people undergoing chemotherapy, people who have organ transplants, people on certain medications that depress your immune system, those people are very vulnerable to infections. Their condition might not allow them to be immunized, or their condition might not allow them to receive certain treatments if they do get sick. And so it's really important to prevent them from getting sick. If those people are surrounded by healthy people who can't get infected, who then can't pass it to them, they have this extra layer of protection to help them avoid getting sick and especially getting really sick. This gives those people time for a newborn baby to grow older and let their immune system develop, for someone on chemotherapy to finish therapy and have time for their immune system to become more robust again. And so that in those later days, when their immune system is stronger, if they get an infection, they'll be able to fight it off. And so as a community, herd immunity is about doing our best to protect that individual who can't right now protect themselves. And so if all of us are immune to something like COVID-19, it really reduces the spread and really helps protect those who are most vulnerable.
As we approach the new school year with our students in large part returning to the classroom in large numbers on site, and given the fact that children under the age of 12 are not eligible to be vaccinated currently, is there a particular concern among public health professionals like yourself as to what that congregation of people in one place, these students, particularly under the age of 12, is there a particular concern about how widely the virus may spread among that particular community.
It is something that we are all watching very closely. You know, I think we've, most communities have gotten a glimpse of children going back in person, as they, many schools were able to do that, at least in part at the end of last school year. There are several studies that have documented that it can be done safely, that with all of the mitigation measures that have been recommended both by the CDC as well as CDPH and the California Department of Education, that those mitigation measures can help reduce the risk of transmission in schools. We know that kids pass germs around. We've known that forever. And so it's really important to help encourage our children to be good at washing their hands, be good at, you know, covering their cough, that parents are really good about keeping their kids home if they feel sick, because that reduces the risk to the rest of that, that school setting. This is something we are all going to watch closely. Anytime you have lots of people together, you run that risk of an outbreak. It only takes one child to bring it into a classroom, or an adult to bring it into a classroom, to infect a lot of vulnerable children. And so it's really important. It's going to be really important for us moving forward to make sure that we implement effectively those mitigation measures that have been outlined, and that we all do everything we can to protect our children. They are part of the most vulnerable, and we want to make sure that they can continue to go to school. We know that it was difficult for a lot of children to be, you know, learning virtually over the last school year, and we want to be able to keep them in the classroom. In order to do that, we have to make sure we can keep them in the classroom safely. You know, because there's a piece of many parents who are worried about sending their kid into a classroom with another 30 children who they don't control, you know, what kind of risks are involved with those children. And we want to make sure that we create an environment where parents feel safe sending their child back, where children feel safe coming back, and that we can still create a really rich learning environment for them. And so, you know, all the different layers of mitigation that we've talked about, you know, including masking, including distancing, including ventilation, those things all help ensure that the kids can come back safely.
Kim, is there anything else you'd like to share or advice you might want to give for our school community as we head into the 21-22 school year, given the state of the pandemic? Is there anything else you would like to share?
I think we'd like to mention, you know, because there is a lot of talk of people saying that kids don't get sick, you know, and we know here in Kern County that we've had over 14,000 children in Kern County with COVID-19. It's about 12% of our overall cases. What we've seen recently, however, is that children now account for about 18% of cases. And so that has crept up since about April. And this is something we're watching closely. And that, you know, as that goes up, we want to make sure that people are aware of the children that we have been able to interview. 71% of them have symptoms. So the kids are sick. Children do get sick from COVID-19. And so we want to dispel that myth that kids don't catch it, that kids don't get sick. They do get sick. And we wanted to briefly talk about multi-inflammatory syndrome in children, MISC. This is a condition where the heart, the lungs, the brain, your skin, your gastrointestinal system, they can become inflamed as a result of a past COVID-19 infection. MISC often requires hospitalization, and it can be life-threatening. In some instances, those children who develop MISC never even knew they had a COVID-19 infection. They had an asymptomatic infection, but weeks later, they develop a sort of hyperimmune response where their organ systems get inflamed, and then they get really sick. There's been over 500 cases in California. Here in Kern County, we've investigated 21 of those cases. Almost all of the kids identified in Kern County have been hospitalized. Several of them have gone to multiple hospitals. 57% of them had to be admitted to the ICU. And, you know, all of those children who were hospitalized spent a couple of days, but some of those kids are hospitalized for months. And so while MISC is very, very rare, it is something that is still out there. It is something that is life-threatening, and it happens predominantly in children. So at this time, the only way to prevent MISC is to not get infected with COVID. So while it's still rare, you know, it's still one of those things that we all want to do our best to protect our kids, because, you know, 21 kids doesn't sound like a lot, but if one of those is yours, you know, this is potentially life-changing for your child. And so we do want to do everything we can to reduce transmission in our community, to protect our most vulnerable, including our children, and hopefully continue to move forward, you know, in our lives with COVID-19 still circulating.
Well, Kim, this has been a most interesting discussion, and on behalf of the Kern County School community and the Self-Insured Schools of California, I really want to thank you for taking the time and preparing for this interview and giving such complete answers. Your expertise is most appreciated, and thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of the CISC podcast and greatly appreciate you listening to our show. Please check the CISC property and liability website at cisc.kern.org for a complete listing of podcast topics under the property and liability tab. Until next time, stay safe as we continue with the CISC mission of schools helping schools.
Production facilities for the CISC podcast are provided by KETN, a service of the Kern County Superintendent of Schools.